Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to this special edition of State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, and this week, I'm actually in Mexico. The State of Belief staff already knows about my love of Mexican-American cuisine, and now I'm down here getting the real thing, as well as enjoying the sights and the culture of our neighbors to the south. But before I left, I had the chance to sit down with two journalists who have helped foster a dialogue on religion that is little seen in the mainstream media. Today, our entire show will consist of my conversation with Newsweek editor John Meacham and Washington Post columnist Sally Quinn. They're the creators of the Newsweek Washington Post blog called On Faith, and two of the leading journalists covering religion in America today. We'll talk about their personal journeys of faith. We'll address the ever-present notion that the United States is considered by many a Christian nation. And we'll get their thoughts on the interaction of religion, politics, and the media. We also want to take a moment to congratulate John and Sally for being named the recipients of the Interfaith Alliance's 10th Annual Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. Since 1998, the Interfaith Alliance has been recognizing individuals who promote democratic values, defend religious liberty, and reinvigorate informed civic participation. Award recipients embody the values of civility, tolerance, diversity, and cooperation in the name of advancing the public dialogue. In just over 2 weeks, on Election Day, as a matter of fact, we're honored to be presenting this year's award to John Meacham and Sally Quinn. It was nearly a year ago that John and Sally began moderating the On Faith blog, a joint venture that they started as an interactive conversation on religion with a panel of experts and specialists who are joined in print on the blog's pages by readers from all walks of life. It's been a great experience for me to be a part of the On Faith blog as a panelist, and we've drawn a lot from its content on State of Belief. I'll get into the impact the On Faith blog has had in just a few minutes, but first, a little more background on our guests, direct from John and Sally themselves. Sally spoke to us from the radio studios of the Washington Post. John joined us from his New York office at Newsweek. John and Sally, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As we start this conversation, I think it might be helpful if each of you would give us just a glimpse of your personal pilgrimage related to religion. For example, how did it get started?
Well, John, I think you probably should start first.
Well, I was about three in St. Paul's Church in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I grew up in the Episcopal Church and went to parochial schools. I went to an Episcopal Montessori, which is kind of redundant when you think about it, but I've always been part of the church. And as I grew up, was very intrigued consistently by the role of religion in the history of nations and the history of culture. And there was nothing, I realized, that had not been touched or shaped by theology or the sacred narrative that whatever one sacred narrative might be, whether it's Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, whatever it might be. And so if one is historically minded, I think you have to be interested in religion. I am a believer. I keep the feast and profess the creeds and believe that essentially the story as related in the Gospels unfolded that way. And am raising my children in the church. Since I'm a high church historian, I suspect they will end up being low church fortune tellers. But we'll keep fighting that battle, as St. Paul taught us.
Sally, how was it for you?
Well, I guess you might say I'm a low church fortune teller, which makes John, which makes the two of us a really interesting team. Well, I was brought up by a mother who was from Savannah, Georgia, Presbyterian, Scottish Presbyterian, and my father was Episcopalian. I, of course, went to Sunday school and said my prayers and all of that. But my father was in World War II. He was an intelligence officer in Germany, and he was there the day they liberated Dachau, the concentration camp. And he had his staff photographer take a lot of photographs of the bodies and the emaciated people who were there. And we had the scrapbook. And when he came back from the war, we had these scrapbooks of the pictures from Dachau that day. And I remember thinking, there can't be a God, because if there were a God, no good God would ever allow this to happen. And so that's when I really lost my faith. And I became, although I didn't know the word, I became an atheist. My father was then in Korea, and we were in Japan at the time, and I was got very sick. I was in the hospital, and I spent the whole time watching these wounded soldiers come back from Korea and with missing limbs and screaming for their mothers. And again, I was my views about religion and God were completely reinforced. When I was 13, I learned the word atheist, and I proudly announced to my father I was an atheist, and he went absolutely nuts. But I had an unwavering faith in atheism, if you can say that. Sure. I just never believed in God. I didn't believe it was possible. And I was angry. I was very angry about the whole idea of religion. And I only saw the evil that was caused by religion. I thought there more evil has been done in the name of religion than in anything else in the world. And in those days, saying you were an atheist was, I mean, it was like saying you were a communist. I didn't use the word that often just because it was so shocking. In fact, I remember when the Clintons first came to Washington, I was seated next to George Stephanopoulos one night at dinner, whose father is an Orthodox Greek priest. And I told him I was an atheist, and I thought George was just going to fall off his chair. I wanted to write a piece about it, and my editors wouldn't let me because they said that it would ruin my career.
Sally, what do you make of this current fascination with Chris Hitchens and Sam Harris and the brand of atheism that they espouse?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, what I was seeing very one-sided was only the bad that religion does. And now I see the good that religion does and how what a force for good it is in the world. I think that atheism is where homosexuals were 20 years ago, that I think that there have always been a lot of atheists or doubters or non-believers who were afraid, as I was really, or a lot of my friends, to come out of the closet and say that they didn't believe because you were thought to not be a moral person if you weren't a believer. So I think that what's happened is that you have this confluence of real intellectuals like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett, who have all come out at once basically with quite intelligent arguments and pointed out a lot of things that would appear to be nonsensical, and that it has given a lot of people who are not believers the courage to come out and say, well, you know, these guys are really smart and they don't believe. And if they can get up and say it, then I can, too. So, you know, Madeleine Murray O'Hare was not exactly the person you wanted to follow to the ramparts, the original atheist. She was so unattractive. Feminism, I don't think, would have taken off without Gloria Steinem, because she was somebody everybody said, oh, wow, I want to be like her. And so I think that part of that is that they now have a sort of cadre of people that who are respected and admired for their intellect that they can align themselves with.
John, when you dialogue with Chris Hitchens, as I know you have recently on Tim Russert's show, or when you read Sam Harris or talk with him, what from them is most challenging to you and your faith?
The argument about this, what Henry James called the willing suspension of disbelief, that if one believes, as I do, that the tomb on Sunday morning in a springtime in Jerusalem in about the year 30 was empty and had been full the night before. If you believe that, you are believing a fairy tale. And one would not suspend one's reason in almost any other sphere of life. Sam Harris uses a very good analogy about why would you, would you refuse medical treatment based on some idea that an angel would have told you that. My argument back is that I believe in God on the same evidence that I believe in love, in that it is something that produces real effects, but I cannot see it. I feel it. Sometimes I feel its absence. I see how a perversion of that instinct can lead to evil things. Hatred is love inverted. And yet you're not able to grab hold of love and say it lives in this particular house or lives down the street. And I think that one's theocentric ideas are very similar. I can't see God, but I believe he's there because I see the real effects.
We'll continue the conversation with Newsweek's John Meacham and the Washington Post's Sally Quinn in just a moment. I'm going to talk to John about his brilliant op-ed recently in the New York Times on A Nation of Christians is Not a Christian Nation. I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Let's rejoin the conversation I had with John Meacham of Newsweek and Sally Quinn of The Washington Post. Let me take the focus now beyond the two individuals to take a look at the nation, a nation that some people call a Christian nation, a nation that others of us recognize as the most religiously pluralistic nation in the world. John, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I couldn't think more highly of the brilliant op-ed you wrote for the New York Times recently. What prompted you to write that piece? And tell our listeners what point you were wanting to get across there.
Well, thank you. It was a piece related to John McCain's comments a week or two ago now, saying that America was, the Constitution established the United States as a Christian nation. I had read that Saturday or Sunday it came out, and I guess this reveals more about how I spend my free time than I probably should, but one night late last week, I was sort of grumpy about that because McCain should know better, and I ended up writing this piece making the point that it's a theological impossibility to have a Christian nation if you take Christianity at its word and seriously. If, in fact, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither male nor female, there's neither slave nor free, but all are one in Christ Jesus, as St. Paul taught us. If, in fact, God is no respecter of persons, as Paul also said, if it's true, as Job said, that God regards not the rich or the poor, for they're all the work of his hands, then ultimately the faith that most Christians I know profess is something that is above nation, that's above economic station, that's above any kind of distinction of gender or sexuality, and in my view, it is an all-encompassing vision. If you take the Gospels and the New Testament at its word, which I do, and so the idea that we're a Christian nation is a relatively dangerous concept, because I think the sense of it is, if one is a Christian nation and one does something, then it's given sanction by the faith of that nation, even if whatever the nation did is actually a good thing or not. And so I have long believed that the best posture for the American nation is one that our founders were quite good at building for us, which is one of humility, one of letting religion be a thread in the tapestry, but not the whole tapestry, and understanding that we can be a special country with values that are worth emulating without thinking that everything we do is divinely sanctioned.
John's piece was absolutely brilliant, and I'm so glad he wrote it, because actually what John McCain said was not Christian. It was un-Christian. It was un-American. And it was essentially suggesting that we should be a theocracy, which is completely everything that this country is against.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you, Sally, how often do you encounter that kind of USA as Christian nation as you live and move and have your being in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's interesting, Welton. I know you spend a lot of time here, so you know that Washington is an odd place when it comes to religion. I first wrote a piece about religion in Washington about 7 years ago from a cultural and sort of an anthropological point of view. And what I wrote was that it's a city where no one ever talks about their religion. Personally, no one ever discusses it. Most people don't even know what religion their friends are. If they do, they don't know whether they're observant or whether they practice. But then everything in politics is about religion. And anyone who runs for office, I mean, as we all know, nobody could be elected president who claims to be an atheist. There's only one atheist in Congress, and that's Pete Stark, and he won't even talk about it. We tried to get him to do a piece about it for On Faith, and he won't discuss it. And he comes from a very small liberal community in California. But everyone here understands that it is part of the culture that when you're here, you don't talk about it. But when you go out there, and I say that in quotes, to campaign, that you have to use religion in order to get elected. So everyone understands that there's this kind of awful, unmentionable thing that has to be done in order to get back here and get in power. And so everyone turns a blind eye to what might, to many people, appear to be pandering to the public in order to get elected and become powerful. So there is this incredible sort of contrast or conflict between what goes on personally in Washington and what goes on publicly among the people who are in power.
In just a few minutes, I'll talk with John and Sally about whether the First Amendment to the Constitution is in trouble, and if so, why? I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I've been talking with John Meacham, editor of Newsweek, and Sally Quinn, columnist at the Washington Post. Together, they're the creators and moderators of the groundbreaking On Faith blog, and they're also the recipients of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award given by the Interfaith Alliance. I think one of the great contributions that the two of you have made through On Faith, the On Faith blog, is that you've given people an opportunity to discuss these kinds of issues in public with other people who share a passion and an intellect related to them. Which questions from On Faith have generated the most response?
Well, I think we did very well with the Mother Teresa question, because I think that that sort of ultimately comes down to what everyone's concerns are, that she had a crisis of faith. I mean, here was a woman who gave her whole life to God, and yet for most of it didn't actually believe that he existed or wondered whether he existed. And so I think there was a lot of response to that. We've had a lot of response to the questions about Muslims and is Islam a violent religion? Certainly, atheism always gets an enormous amount of attention whenever we do any question about atheism. And I think that what John was talking about love and belief, is one of the things that I think is missing, and certainly was missing in my life when I called myself an atheist, because I do think that we all need some sense of mystery and some sense of the divine and some sense of the spiritual. And I think that as rational as the atheists are, that piece of what we need and who we are as human beings is missing. But it's intellectually challenging, because they can come out with facts after facts after facts, which are totally rational, and they can point out things that are totally irrational. And so you think, well, as a completely rational, intelligent human being, how could I believe this, or how could anyone believe this? So I think John is right about this suspension of belief. And I think that that goes to the issue of what is so attractive about our website, is that people are always struggling and always seeking and always yearning for something beyond themselves.
I've always thought the First Amendment to the Constitution, the religious liberty clauses there, are a brilliant formula for protecting religious pluralism. And I am stunned often to find out how much trouble the First Amendment, and particularly the religious clauses of the First Amendment, are in this nation. What is the beef that people have with separation of church and state?
I think it's a natural outgrowth of strong belief, and I don't criticize that by any means. If you are a deeply religious person and you take scripture and tradition seriously, then it follows that in many ways you would want to see those religious beliefs reflected in the politics and the culture around you. The problem with that is you want to always be careful if you go down that road, because while you may be able to project those beliefs into the politics and culture around you in this generation, what if some other group were to come out on top in the next generation and then enforce their beliefs on you? And that's the reason the founders were, I think, quite brilliantly managed to enable us to have religion as one factor among many in our public life. I think Federalist 10 is one of the great pieces of secular scripture. It argues, you know, that it is a force. Religion is a force, like geography, like partisanship, like economics, that will be a force in the affairs of men, but it must be managed and marshaled. It can't be allowed to dominate, nor should it be crushed and kicked out altogether. Again, like economic interest, like a geographic interest. And so I have some sympathy, or at least I understand why people feel that the country should be more religious or have more public policies that reflect religious values. The problem with that is, as Sally said a second ago, it tends to drive you in a theocratic direction. There are ways to reach the same ends by different means, and I think that's very much what the founders wanted us to do.
Sally, it seems like nearly every week on State of Belief, I'm taking someone in the media to task for the way they've treated religion and politics. I wonder, how do you feel the media is faring in its handling of the interaction between politics and religion?
Well, I think that reporters are generally a little confounded by how to deal with religion and politics. I mean, we obviously have religion reporters who specialize in that, but most of the people who cover politics are political. They may be people of faith or not. I must say that I think Newsweek and John have done an incredible job of covering politics and religion in the most intelligent and sort of illuminating way. But I think that a lot of people just don't know how to deal with it, because it's very hard to determine who is authentic and who is not. And we all know, and we can think of many names of politicians who have been forced to pander to the public in order to get elected. You look at Howard Dean or John Kerry, not that they were pandering, but they were both totally uncomfortable discussing religion. It was not from their culture. It was not something that they had ever done, and yet they felt they had to do it. You see some of the other politicians, I mean, even what John McCain did, said declaring this was a Christian nation, he would feel uncomfortable with voting for a Muslim. And then you look at someone like Barack Obama, who does come across absolutely genuine when he talks about religion. You feel that he is speaking from the heart. But again, who is... How can you judge? I mean, religion is such a personal thing. And that's why the whole separation of church is so important, because it is so personal. You cannot dictate to someone else what he or she should believe. And you can't really judge whether someone is genuine or not. And so I think that that puts reporters who like to deal in facts in a very difficult position.
John, do we have any right to expect media to defend religious freedom and constitutional guarantees like Article 6 of the Constitution during these election discussions?
Sure, in the sense that the press, in whatever particular form is appropriate, when we do editorialize, when we do offer our opinions and we're clear about it, we should be standing up for all kinds of freedoms that strike us as being exercised in a sane way. I think that there shouldn't be a religious test for the White House. I do think if presidential candidates raise the issue, then like courtroom rules, the door has been opened to it, and and we have a right to ask questions about the particularities of their faith. My sense is that, you know, we've had 43 of these guys now, and we have had debates from the very beginning. My favorite thing to say to folks who tell me how awful the press is, and because we're so negative, and because we're negative, politicians are negative, I like to say, well, you know, and you know, John Adams' campaign basically had ads that said, in 1800, you can have Adams and God, or Jefferson and no God. So this is not something Karl Rove invented 20 minutes ago. I think it's a reasonable thing to talk about. And I think the more we talk about it, the better, because then it becomes less scary. The more we cover it, the better. Because you know, the only time we have too much information is when, you know, when we're talking about our personal lives, I think. And so I'm a big fan of letting as much sunlight in as possible.
Well, I was going to say, I just think that we've had a very, that discussing religion and the idea that it's coming up more and more and being reported on more is a very healthy thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Both of you as journalists, how important to you is the religious affiliation of a candidate?
Well, to me, it's not important if you ask the question that way. That is, as one factor, I think we have to judge these men and women on the totality of what they're offering the country. And I think when we try to determine the character of the candidate, and I think if we have learned anything in the last 7 years, we have learned anew the ancient truth that what really matters is the character of the person who is either sitting on the throne or behind the desk, because we can never predict, ever, what's actually going to happen. All you have to do is go back to the 10th of September, 2001. So I think that insofar as one's religious upbringing and belief is a factor in the character of that person and how they think, it's completely fair game to think about it and talk about it.
From my point of view, it's very simple. It's not what you believe, but how you behave.
Mm-hmm.
So who should open the door, or who has opened the door in the discussion on Mitt Romney about his Mormonism? Should that come from Romney, or should that come from the media?
Well, I think we, as someone who just published a cover story on this. We asked him about it. I don't think he was particularly thrilled to hear the question. But when you're a first in anything, you have to be prepared to talk about it. And I think we have an obligation to raise it as well on the same grounds that I just laid out a moment ago, mm-hmm. which is, who are these people? What made them the way they are? And from that, what can we figure out as best we can how they might react under stress in the storm and strife of the present? And it's very clear, even a cursory look at Governor Romney's life, it's very clear that his faith has been very important. And we wanted to look at it. I think Mayor Giuliani's relationship with Catholicism is a fair issue. I think Senator Clinton's kind of social gospel Methodism is fair game. Senator Obama, who's managed to write two memoirs before he was 42, so there's very little unexamined there. That's a legitimate question. So I think as long as it's done respectfully, as long as you give the candidate plenty of time, you know, you walk in the front door, you say, we want to talk about these things, then I think it's a legitimate thing to do, and I think it's a good service.
You know, Hillary Clinton once said that when she got to the White House, she said, I always expected that there would be a certain zone of privacy. But I think that to be elected president of the United States is an enormous honor, an enormous privilege, an enormous responsibility. And I think that it's our responsibility to know as much as we possibly can about the people who we are going to put into these offices. And I think that pretty much anything is fair game. Let us, as John says, let's turn on the lights, let's shine the light on it, open the windows, let's know everything about them, what they believe, what gives them, what guides them, what gives them their morals, their ethics, their values, and then we'll make a decision based on that. And if religion is a huge part of someone's life, then I think we need to know about it.
And to follow up on Sally's said this better than I did, not unusually, I do think that the faith element is one element in the compound. I think that someone's business career, someone's mayoral record, someone's record as first lady, just to pick some examples completely at random, are also hugely important and worthy of our study. And we're going to have a long year next year. We're probably going to know the nominees on the 6th of February. So it's going to be plenty of time for us to discuss probably every Sunday school lesson any of these folks ever went to. By the time we're done.
We'll wrap up our conversation with a little discussion on the one and only Walter Cronkite, and that's the way it is. I'm Welton Getty, and you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio.
Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty with the conclusion of my conversation with John Meacham of Newsweek and Sally Quinn of The Washington Post. In just a few days, I will have the privilege of handing to each one of you one of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards. I can't let the discussion of media go without asking you a question about Walter Cronkite. What are your thoughts about this man?
Well, I've known Walter Cronkite for a long time. I was actually an intern working for CBS when Walter was the anchor man. He was God. and we all genuflected. Speaking of religion. and I can't tell you how much respect and admiration I have for him. I think he really set the tone for for good journalism in this country. And I mean, he was one of the first big television stars. And he is a person of enormous integrity and has great morals and values. I know that my husband, Ben Bradley, has always looked up to Walter Cronkite. And I can't think of a better person to have this award named after.
I'm hugely honored and humbled. Cronkite was always on in my house growing up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And you think back to just two moments where he made such an extraordinary difference. The first was his report in 67, 68 from Vietnam, which prompted President Johnson to say, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. And then something that Sally knows well, as does Ben. You know, it was October, I think, of 72 when he gave over most of the broadcast to a story that had been being done piecemeal in the Washington Post and other places, really pulling it together and trying to put it in context, called Watergate. And I think Ben writes in his memoir, and others have made this point, that having Cronkite's blessing at that point in 1972, just, what, 5 months after the break-in, was a hugely important moment in encouraging everyone to keep working. And we know how that story ended, and the country was better off. And those are just two examples of how he has shaped and really suffused the life of the nation.
John Meacham and Sally Quinn, I'm glad to tell both of you that you have his blessing as being recipients of this award, because I've heard it with my own ears. And I thank you both for spending this time with us on State of Belief. And again, congratulations on receiving the 10th Annual Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award.
Oh, thank you so much, Welton.
Well, that's our show for this week. You've heard these two journalists talk about the power of the media and other sources of power in our society. But I want to remind you, listeners, the real power is in your hand. You are change agents. Don't waste the influence that is yours. And don't forget to stay in touch with us at stateofbelief.com. Click on the Contact Us page to send us an email, or you can call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. And if you like what you heard on this show, why not think about becoming a member of the Interfaith Alliance? Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week, I'll be back stateside for a conversation with Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping. You heard me. I want my wife to hear this. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.